Yeah, I want to talk today about the subject of worship. Last time I spoke, which I think was about 3 weeks ago, we talked about praise. So it seemed a reasonable next thing to talk about, because often we put those two things together, don't we? Praise and worship. And last time when I spoke, I mentioned three words. I began with the word thanksgiving. And I made the point that thanksgiving, you know, God might do something for you and you give him thanks. Someone else might do something for you and you give your thanks to them. But it's quite sort of low level. It's a sort of an entry level way that we might communicate with God. And the Bible says that we come into his gates with thanksgiving. It's a first step through the door. And then praise goes to a deeper level. We enter his courts with praise. It's a bit like you came in this morning. You maybe have come through the gate on the car park and then you've come through the doors. You've come in deeper. And praise takes us to that deeper level. And praise has to be expressed. It has to be the fruit of our lips. It's not something that happens deep in our head. It is. That's a nice little sound. Yeah. Thanks, Robin. Musical accompaniment. So what is worship then? If we've thought briefly, recap briefly about thanksgiving and praise, what is worship? Well, the first thing that worship is a really, really big subject, which is not going to all be covered in the next 28 minutes and 38 seconds that I've got left. So if you go away today and you go, oh, she didn't say this and she didn't say that, you know, very likely there will be bits that could happen on another day. I'm sorry if I'm going to spoil this for some people, but so often when we talk about worship, we think about come on a Sunday morning to church and we sing to God together. That's our worship. We come, we bring our worship. And there's an element of truth in that. But if we see worship as just coming on a Sunday and singing those four or five songs, then actually we've sold it really, really short. And in danger of devaluing what it actually is. Of course, for those of you who really don't like singing, that's probably good news. And there will be some of you. Worship means to give homage to bow down, to prostrate yourself. Worship is like the deepest level of communion with God. And fundamentally, it's an attitude and a posture that we take before him. Let me read Psalm 96 to you. Sing to the Lord a new song. Sing to the Lord all the earth. Sing to the Lord, praise his name. Proclaim his salvation day after day. Declare his glory among the nations, his marvelous deeds among the people. For great is the Lord and most worthy of praise. He is to be feared above all gods. For all the gods of the nations are idols, but the Lord made the heavens. Splendor and majesty are before him. Strength and glory are in his sanctuary. Ascribe to the Lord, all you families of nations, ascribe to the Lord glory and strength. Ascribe to the Lord the glory due his name. Bring an offering and come into his courts. Worship the Lord in the splendor of his holiness. Tremble before him, all the earth. This psalm has a lot of instructions. Tells us to sing to the Lord, to praise, to declare, to use your mouth to testify of his goodness. But then it says, worship the Lord in the splendor, or some translations say, in the beauty of his holiness. So why do we worship God? Basically, at the fundamental level, we worship God because he is great. And because he is the creator, he made everything. And I was thinking about this week, about this idea of God being the creator. And I was thinking, you know what? Our world has removed God from being the creator. Or at least they have in their own minds. Obviously, they can't actually do that. You know, if you believe today that God created the world and everything in it, then frankly, according to the world view, they would see you as being quite weird. Quite strange. Now, I want to just put a little thing in here. I'm not saying You see, some people will say, well, we read in Genesis 1, you know, God created the earth 6 periods of 24 hours. Was that actual literal? You know, was that a metaphoric thing? What, you know, people discuss those things, don't they? And they come to their own conclusions. And you can discuss those things over dinner if you want to. I'm not actually saying, you know, is there a debate over was Genesis 1 scientific or not? What I'm saying is fundamentally, as Christians, we believe that God created everything out of nothing. Whereas if you don't believe that, you believe that something created itself out of nothing. All right? So that's the difference that I'm getting to. God is the creator, and we believe that as Christians, that God made the heavens and the earth and everything that we see in it. Amen. But man, in his wisdom, in the 19th century, removed God from that creative picture. And when you remove God from that creative picture, all sorts of things start to happen. Because fundamentally, you've removed the object of our worship. We're created to worship. We remove the object of worship. We have a problem. And this is, what I think, one of the really fundamental issues in our world. Because what do you do? You're created to worship. You don't have an object of your worship. Some people worship themselves. They put themselves into the center of their own world. And if you take that to its nth degree, you get a problem called narcissism. And narcissism leads to shamelessness, arrogance, envy, entitlement, and exploitation. And some people suffer at the hands of people who have this worldview. And I'm not an expert, but even just in that one word, exploitation, you can cover so many of the issues that we have in this world. Modern slavery, unfair trade between rich and poor, domestic violence, abuse. The word entitlement. There are people who absolutely hold up their personal rights to do whatever and be whoever they want to be, regardless of the consequences for anyone else. Lots of rights, but no responsibility. Now, I'm not making a personal judgment on the individual people, and I'm not saying that everyone who isn't a Christian is like this by any means. But generally, big picture, as we look at our society, I think a lot of our issues can be traced back fundamentally to the fact that we've removed the creator, we've removed the object of our worship. That's a big subject which we could talk about some other time. We've given ourselves a big problem. God is supreme. He's all-knowing. He's all-powerful. He's everywhere at once. That's why we worship him. He's still worthy of our worship. If God never did anything for us or never did anything for us ever again, he is still worthy of our worship. And the psalm says we worship him in the splendor of his holiness. God is holy. And in a way, when we worship him, when we bow down, we're kind of putting ourselves voluntarily into the framework that he created for us to exist in. That might be a bit like, what did she just say? You know, God's created order. He's created this framework, and we need to live in the proper place. And when we worship, when we bow down to him, when we come with an attitude of heart, we're kind of putting ourselves into that framework voluntarily. What does holy mean? We worship in the splendor of holiness. God is holy. You might think, oh, well, of course, God's perfect. God never does anything wrong. Correct? But God's never done anything wrongness is because he's holy. It's not actually holiness as such in itself. Holy means to be apart, to be separated. We worship God because he is apart or he's separate from us. Oh, hang on a minute. I thought God wanted a close relationship. What happened to I'll never leave you or forsake you? Does worship then take us away from God? No. This holy apartness just means that God is different from us. We worship him because he's not like us. Again, society who's removed God, sometimes they worship other people. From there we get celebrity culture. People look at the lives of others and they want to be like them. I wish I had their life. I wish I had their status. I wish I had their money. I wish I was thin like they are. I want to be famous. I want to be successful like them. But you know, the celebrity culture is quite sad. I saw on Facebook today, even this morning, that there was a young man who'd been on something called Celebrity Love Island, which I can't say I've ever watched, and I won't ask for a show of hands. But, you know, these are young adults, apparently, on this show, and one of them has died. He's 26, and it sounds like he's taken his own life. And when I read it, it sounded like he was the second one. And you think, that's wrong. What is wrong? They have all of the fame and the fortune and everything, but it clearly isn't working. Jim Carrey, an A-list actor, said this: I hope everyone could get rich and famous and have everything they ever dreamed of, so that they will know it's not the answer. Celebrity culture, created by removing God from the picture. God says, worship me, put yourself in your proper position before me, because I created you, I'm not like you, and because I'm not like you, I'm all the things you're not, and I am all you will ever need. It's really hard to find words to express some of this stuff, but worship the Lord in the beauty of holiness could say something like this: take a fitting posture before God, because he is beautifully and infinitely more than you. God is everything. Without him, you wouldn't be here. We owe him everything, and we find everything in him. The Apostle Paul said this to people in Athens in Acts 17. He said this: Paul then stood up in the meeting of the Areopagus and said, "People of Athens, I see that in every way you are very religious. For as I walked around and looked carefully at your objects of worship, I even found an altar with this inscription, 'To an unknown God.' So you are ignorant of the very thing you worship, and this is what I'm going to proclaim to you. The God who made the world and everything in it is the Lord of heaven and earth, and does not live in temples built by human hands. He's not served by human hands as if he needed anything. Rather, he himself gives everyone life and breath and everything else. From one man he made all the nations that they should inhabit the whole earth. He marked out their appointed times in history and the boundaries of their lands. God did this so that they would seek him and perhaps reach out for him and find him, though he is not far from any of us. For in him we live and move and have our being." Outside of God, we can't live, we can't move, we can't even exist. I'm trying to paint a picture here of why we should worship God, how amazing God is. But like I say, it's really, really difficult to find the words sometimes. It can be really difficult to describe. And I want to just quickly play you a short video. This is an old preacher who is trying to describe Jesus to his congregation. Wow. Do you want to just start praising God now? Shall I just leave? You know, I love the way he goes, "I wish I could describe him to you." He's having a really good go at it. But you know, I'm just used that because I thought there's so many words in there that can describe God, describe our God, describe Jesus. How do we worship him? If worship is a posture or in the way that we position ourselves before God, how do we worship? King David said this in Psalm 27. He says, "One thing I ask from the Lord, this only do I seek, that I may dwell in the house of the Lord all the days of my life, to gaze on the beauty of the Lord and to seek him in his temple." The beauty of God and the holiness of God are the same thing. God isn't beautiful in the human sense, because if God was beautiful in a human sense, then beauty's in the eye of the beholder, isn't it? God's beauty, his pleasing combination of his qualities, the delightful loveliness and majestic grandeur of God. To gaze on the beauty of the Lord is to wonder at his attributes, and it's an infinite wonder. So the focus of David's whole life, the one thing he desired, was to spend time looking at God. God, that David sought one thing. How many things do we seek? When I was a kid, we used to have a board game called The Game of Life. Don't know if any of you have heard of it. seen it, played it. And you started off the game of life with a little car in different colour. And there was some little space for some little pegs in the car. And you were given a blue peg if you were a boy and a pink peg if you were a girl. Life was so simple back then. And you popped it in your little car and you put it on the start and off you toddled round the board. And as you moved round the board, you would gain an education or a job depending on where you landed. And that determined your salary. And then everyone got to a point where everyone had to stop outside a church and get married. Didn't matter where you were, what bit of the game, everyone had to get married. And then you would get your little peg in the opposite colour to put in your car. And then you moved on through life and whatever life threw at you, depending on where you landed. And eventually you got to the end and you ended up either in the millionaire's mansion or the old people's home. And when everyone had arrived at either the millionaire's mansion or the old people's home, the game was over and the one with the most money won. Trouble was that by then the game was over, so however much money you had was now, of course, irrelevant. Not real money, so it was irrelevant anyway, but you get the point I'm making. You know, we could do a whole teaching series just based on that game. I tell you, there's so much there. What's the point? What thing are you seeking? Are you seeking to dwell in the house of the Lord and gaze on the beauty of the Lord? Or are you seeking to be a winner in the game of life, whatever being a winner looks like to you? So does that mean then that I don't need to get out of bed in the morning? I can just lie around basking in the glory of God? Does this mean I don't have to join the daily commute, take the children to school or do any washing? Sadly, no. David, King David was a very active person. He led people. He fought battles. He danced. He sang. He played music. It's not about what you're doing or not doing. It's about what you're seeking. One of my key scriptures in life that kind of comes back and back over and over again is Matthew 6:33. And in the Message translation, it says this: steep your life in God reality, God initiative, God's provisions. Don't worry about missing out. You'll find your everyday human concerns will be met. I wonder if any of you recognize the traditional translation of that. It's actually, seek first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, and all these things will be added to you. And another clue to this posture of worship is Romans 12:1, which says, therefore I urge you, brothers and sisters, in view of God's mercy, offer your bodies as a living sacrifice, holy and pleasing to God. This is your true and proper worship. The posture of worship is all about our priorities and our focus. True worship is defined by the priority we place on who God is in our lives and where God is in our list of priorities. A good clue sometimes used to be to read through your checkbook stubs to find out where your priorities were. But it doesn't work anymore, does it? Do you try and fit Jesus into your diary, or do you plan your diary around him? Eugene Peterson, who wrote the Message translation, puts it this way: God cannot fit into our plans. We must fit into his. We can't use God. God is not a tool or an appliance or a credit card. Holy is the word that sets God apart and above our attempts to enlist him in our wish fulfillment fantasies or our utopian schemes for making our mark in the world. Holy means that God is alive on God's terms, alive in a way that exceeds our experience and imagination. Holy refers to life burning with an intense purity that transforms everything it touches into itself. We have to get to that place where we put ourselves in that right framework, that right position, that right posture before God. And it's not just about Sundays, it's about every day of the week. But there is an element of worship that also talks about giving honour to. And there's a very famous story I'm going to read in Luke 14 now, which I'm not going to go into great details about. I just want to kind of pick out one thing. But this is a story of a lady who came and gave great honour to Jesus. While he was in Bethany, reclining at the table in the home of Simon the leper, a woman came with an alabaster jar of very expensive perfume made of pure nard. She broke the jar and poured the perfume on his head. Some of those present were saying indignantly to one another, "Why this waste of perfume? It could have been sold for more than a year's wages and the money given to the poor." And they rebuked her harshly. "Leave her alone," said Jesus. "Why are you bothering her? She's done a beautiful thing to me. The poor you will always have with you, and you can help them any time you want. But you will not always have me. She did what she could. She poured perfume on my body beforehand to prepare for my burial. Truly, I tell you, wherever the gospel is preached throughout the world, what she's done will be told in memory of her." You know, worship is to honor God with extravagant love and extreme submission. That perfume was worth more than a year's wages. On Friday, I was talking to my daughter and she said, "I wonder what the average wage is in the UK. And I said, £28,677 a year, according to 2018 Office of National Statistics. And her chin like dropped on her chest. She was like, "How do you know that?" I said, "I just looked it up for my talk." Yeah, £28,677 a year is the average wage apparently in the UK last year. So you can decide if you're above or below average. The most expensive perfume that I could find on the internet was called Clive Christian No. 1 Imperial Majesty Perfume. This is a sophisticated scent for women who want a perfume that is both weightless and enchanting. The scent is that of a light, enchanting scent of Tahitian vanilla with a hint of Rosa centrifolis that is reminiscent of the goddess of love and beauty, Aphrodite. At the heart of the perfume is ylang ylang and will give a woman a sense of wearing a perfect diamond necklace around their neck. The perfume sells for $12,721.89 an ounce. Mother's Day is coming up, boys. Can you imagine spending that much on perfume? And how on earth perfume makes you feel you've got a necklace on? For goodness sake, tell you what. But can you imagine if you own something that's actually more worth more than that, if it's £28,000 a year and dollars and pounds and stuff? Imagine you own something like that, that valuable. And bear in mind, this is a place where you don't have like benefits if you lose your job or your income, or you know what I mean? It's like, this could be almost like a life investment, something that you've got invested for your pension or something, you know. Imagine you've got something that valuable and you're going to take it and you're going to break it over Jesus' head. That's extravagant worship. But again, it's an act of worship. The worship itself is in the honour and the submission that the woman was giving to Jesus. True worship is a matter of the heart expressed through a lifestyle of holiness. Holiness, there's that word again, that set apartness. You know, we worship God in his holiness by setting ourselves apart for him. In other words, being holy. Now, we all know that we're not perfect and God sees us through Jesus. So I'm not wanting to tell you about holiness in that respect. Holiness is us setting ourselves apart for God in the way that he has set himself apart. 1 Peter 2 verse 9 says this, "You are a chosen people, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, God's special possession, that you may declare the praises of him who called you out of darkness into his wonderful light." There's that calling out, there's that separateness that we do in order to honour God. But what does that actually mean in practice on a Monday morning? Because sometimes when we think about people being separate and separating themselves apart for God, we tend to think about nuns and monks and people who kind of go and live somewhere and have a holy life or something. Or sometimes we think we need to avoid the world, be separate from the world completely. But that's not what it means. John 17:13, Jesus prays with his disciples and he says, I'm coming to you now, but I say these things while I'm still in the world, so that they may have the full measure of my joy within them. I have given them your word, and the world has hated them, for they're not of the world any more than I am of the world. See, Jesus is saying his disciples, they're separated. My prayer, though, is not that you take them out of the world, but that you protect them from the evil one. They're not of the world, even as I am not of it. Sanctify them by the truth, and your word is truth. As you sent me into the world, I have sent them into the world. So hang on, are we in the world? Are we out of the world? You know, we are in the world. We live our lives in this world. But we have to be separated to God in that existence. We have to live this holy life. We have to be different to the way our neighbours and our friends and our colleagues behave. We have to have that different order of priorities that they may have. We have to be seeking God's kingdom, not seeking to be a winner in the game of life. Being holy is not about escaping from the world. It's allowing our transformed lives to touch the world, and in so doing, see that world transformed. So we worship because of who God is. Perhaps the worship team could actually head back. Might need to rename you now, actually, but we worship God because of who he is. We worship God by sacrificially setting ourselves apart for him being holy. We posture ourselves before him appropriately, being mindful that he is set apart and holy. So we take our place in the world in which we live, recognizing that we are called to be different, to be God's special possession, to be in the world but not part of it. And how I want us to respond to this today is actually we're going to sit for a few moments just in silence. And I want you in that silence. You see, praise needs words, worship doesn't. But in that few moments of silence before we do sing, because we can sing and give homage to God, I'm not in any way saying that we can't do that. This is still part of our worship. It's an expression. It's bringing that homage to God. But before we get to that point of bringing that homage, let's have some time of just quiet. And just in your own heart, just talk to God and just say, God, you know, if you want to do this, you know, God, I put myself in that place. I put myself in that right place. I bring myself before you. I bow myself before you. If during this time you can kneel, you can bow if you want to, that's fine. But just put your heart in that place. And we're just going to do that in the silence. And then in a few moments, we are going to sing and we're going to bring our honor and glory to God and then take communion.